So we'll be in Matthew chapter 2, if you want to go ahead and turn there and join us. If not, I'll get to it and we'll read it. But have you guys heard the story of the time, right, that Vincent van Gogh? The story is a little bit cloudy, depending on which historian you listen to. Either Van Gogh cut off his own ear or someone else cut off his ear for him. I don't know how it went down. It's a weird story either way. But once Van Gogh's ear came off of his body, what he did is he put it in a box and then he gifted it to a romantic interest of his. Like, Merry Christmas, here's my ear, right? Really, really weird. We would look at that story, and rightly so, it is odd. We would say, Sir Vincent, that's a little bit weird. It's a little bit too much, right? It was odd for you to do that. But yet he did it, which means that, you know, gifting his ear to a woman that he was romantically interested in somehow in his own mind made sense to him. How about this? You guys have heard of the Taj Mahal. The Taj Mahal is one of the modern seven wonders of the world, and it was built by an Indian ruler who lost his wife prematurely and loved her so much that he wanted to build a proper and fitting memorial to her. Now, when we think of a memorial to someone that we love, we don't quite think on the scale of a seven wonders of the world kind of scale, but he did. And some people would say, regarding the Taj Mahal as a memorial to a human being, we'd say, wow, that's a little bit extravagant. It's a lot. It's lavish. But he did it. And he would say that his love compelled him to do it. Or how about this? This is probably 3 to 4 weeks ago, where many people in Northeast Ohio got out their 25-foot ladders and scaled up to the second floor of their home and started hanging lights from their gutters. And they braved the elements, and it was cold and maybe snowy, maybe there's some precipitation coming down, but they would not be deterred. And not only standing 20 feet up and hanging lights from their Christmas gutters, not only did they have to deal with the rigors of that, but from time to time, as they're hanging lights and Christmas decorations, the technological issues would arise where this string of lights isn't lighting up and those set of lights aren't lighting up and this little movable thing in your front yard isn't turning the way that it's supposed to. And they'd have to step in and technologically problem solve all manner of things. And some of us would look at that and say, like, wow, that's a bit extravagant. That's a lot for you to spend several days decorating your house for Christmas in that fashion. But those that do it would look back and say, oh, no, it's not extravagant. It's not a lot. It makes perfect sense to me. It only makes sense if you love Christmas enough to go through all of that. Here's the point I'm getting at. When you love something and or someone with a high degree of love, you will do things for that thing or that person that are perceived by others to be excessive or unreasonable. When you love something or someone, you will do things that are perceived to be unreasonable and or excessive to those that don't have the same love for that thing or that person. It should be in Matthew chapter 2 now, if you're going to join us. Matthew chapter 2, I want to take a look at something that some might perceive to be excessive or maybe unreasonable. But let's dig in, and maybe we'll find out why it's not unreasonable and or excessive. Matthew chapter 2, starting in verse 1. Now, after Jesus was born in Bethlehem of Judea in the days of Herod the king, behold, wise men or magi from the east came to Jerusalem saying, where is he who has been born the king of the Jews? For we saw his star when it rose and have come to worship him. Now, regarding these magi from the east that have come to bow before young Jesus, many scholars connect these wise men from the east with events that happened several hundred years earlier. And if you remember, the Babylonians came in around 585, 586 BC and took over Israel. Judah, particularly. Israel was already dispersed among the nations, but they came in and they took over Judah. And at that time, names like Daniel and Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, familiar names to us, these were young Israelite men of great promise, and like many of them their age, the Babylonians took them out of Judah and then took them back to Babylon so that they could become in service to the Babylonian Empire. And while we have the historical record, while Daniel and Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego were in Babylon, they continued to worship the one true God, of whom the Babylonians had only heard accounts of. And the Lord was gracious and kind to Daniel and Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, and others for whom we don't have their recorded stories detailed in exile in Babylon. And what seems to have happened, according to many scholars, is that Babylonians, many of them of the wise astrologer, magician, enchanter class, of whom Daniel was the chief, many of them came to believe in the one true God and to honor and revere him in the same way that Daniel and his three friends did. They saw that this was the creator and sustainer of the heavens and the earth, who indeed did make himself known and present to people on earth. And so, right, it developed in this class of magi or wise men in the east, the former Babylonian Empire regions, that there's a group of these wise intellectuals, learned, discerning people who loved God, and then that passed on to the next generation and to the next generation and to the next. And they knew from Daniel, plus the prophets of the Hebrews of old, that this God who has made himself known in Babylon through these exiles was not done with the world, but he had a promised one who would sit on a throne over all things and make the world right again. And so here we go, some 500 years after Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego depart from the earth, their legacy continues, and these wise men from the east are eagerly searching and yearning to see how God is moving on earth. And then they discern through the stars and probably dreams and visions, I don't know specifically, that God is on the move. Specifically, God is on the move coming to earth. And so these magi do what many would perceive to be unreasonable, but to them seems eminently reasonable. They make an incredibly far and distant journey from the places in the east where they resided, and they make their way to a little town of Bethlehem, and they come to the place where Jesus is, and they bow before Jesus in worship. Check it out in verse 9. Second half of verse 9 and then into 10. And behold, the star that they had seen when it rose went before them until it came to rest over the place where the child was. When they saw the star, they rejoiced exceedingly with great joy. Right? If you're looking for multipliers of descriptions regarding someone having joy in their heart, here's a bunch. The Magi rejoiced exceedingly with great joy. Right? So in verbal form here, what's going on in the heart of these wise men from the east is similar to what was going on in John the Baptist in the womb of his mother Elizabeth when, in proximity to Jesus, he just started turning cartwheels. Baby John the Baptist is on the move because why? Well, because he's rejoicing exceedingly and with great joy. It's the same thing that David did when he was bringing the Ark of the Covenant back into Jerusalem, when David is leaping and dancing all over the streets, rejoicing exceedingly with great joy. Finally, the Magi have closed the distance between them and this God whom they have been diligently following, who is now in proximity to them, and they worship. Verse 11. And going into the house, they saw the child with Mary, his mother, and they fell down and they worshiped him. Then, opening their treasures, they offered him gifts, gold and frankincense and myrrh. Right? So we talked about this last week, that oftentimes when joy fills our hearts, then our bodies start to follow. Our bodies start to move a little bit. That's exactly what happens to these learned intellectuals from the East who are seeking God. They've got joy in their hearts and it causes their bodies to move, specifically to bow low. And in addition to falling down, they offer what could only be described as extravagant, lavish gifts. Right? And some people who would maybe be watching this from a distance, maybe peering around a street corner, seeing the scene of the wise men presenting gold and frankincense and myrrh, costly items. They might look at that and they might say something like, wow, that's too much. Or if you ever get the chance to hang out with middle schoolers, maybe they would sound like this. Dude, man, that's a lot. Bro, man, that's a lot. That gold, frankincense, and myrrh for the child? Dude, bro, that's a whole lot. Why would you bow low? Why would you give such gifts? That seems to be a little bit too much to offer this toddler in whose presence you find yourself. But if the wise men were presented with that challenge, guys, it seems a little bit too lavish, it's a little bit too much, I think this would be their response. Oh, no, it's not. It is not too much. It's actually not enough. They would say, I wish we could bow lower than we are currently bowing. I can't get any lower than this, but I wish we could move our bodies into a more prostrate position, because that would be fitting. I wish that we could give more gold, more frankincense, more myrrh. We brought what we could. I wish we could have brought more, but what we are doing in bowing and what we are giving in gifts, it is not enough for such a one. They would say that what they are doing is eminently reasonable and proper. Why? Because they love God. And when you love someone or something excessively and beautifully, you will do things for that one that others perceive to be and believe to be unreasonable. Now, with that in mind, I want us to fast forward towards the end of the book of Matthew and look at another story of perceived unreasonability. Matthew chapter 26, starting in verse 6. Now, when Jesus was at Bethany in the house of Simon the leper, a woman came up to him with an alabaster flask of very expensive ointment, and she poured it on his head as he reclined at the table. Now, just out of the gate, we got to recognize that this is a little bit of an odd scene. Have you ever been to a dinner party where you're sitting around the table and you're telling jokes and telling stories and having fun and eating and drinking and everything's going great, and then somebody walks in with this jar and starts dumping the jar over the head of somebody at the table? Right? No, you've never been to a party where that happens. But that's exactly what happens here. This woman, presumably Mary, not Jesus' mother, but of Mary and Martha, this woman pours very expensive ointment on Jesus' head and it moves its way down his body. And check out what happens in verse 8. And when the disciples saw it, they were indignant, saying, why this waste? For this could have been sold for a large sum, and it could have been given to the poor. It's very different than rejoicing exceedingly with great joy. Different words here. The disciples are indignant and they say, what a waste. In their anger, they say, why have you done this thing? Woman, what you have just done here to Jesus in our presence is unreasonable. To which maybe she would say, come again? Unreasonable? How so, disciples? Would you say that what I have done for Jesus is too lavish for him? Would you say that what I've done is it's too costly for him, that he doesn't deserve something like this, that Jesus somehow is not worth what I have just done for him? Is that what you were saying in your anger and in calling this a waste? Let's be clear, disciples. What exactly are you saying? Right? Because here's the thought. Maybe this woman doesn't have a problem with being unreasonable. Maybe the problem in the room is that some of the disciples are just not quite loving enough. So that what this woman has done, it doesn't make sense to them. But because she loves Jesus so much, she will do, out of exceedingly great joy, what everybody else perceives to be such an unreasonable waste. She doesn't have a reasonable problem. You have a love problem. And now in the very next story that Matthew documents for us, it all kind of comes together, and this is where things get really trippy, and we're going to have to start doing some application work. Matthew chapter 26, verse 14, very next section, after this woman pours this very expensive perfume ointment over Jesus' head, some of the disciples say, what a waste. They are angry. Then, verse 14, right? Because of what this one of the 12 just saw. Then one of the 12, whose name was Judas Iscariot, went to the chief priests and said, what will you give me if I deliver him over to you? And they paid him 30 pieces of silver. And from that moment, he, Judas, sought an opportunity to betray him, Jesus. What's going on here in Matthew 26, verses 14 to 16? What we've got here is worship. It's worship in a very similar vein to the woman that just had poured ointment over Jesus' head. Worship that's similar to what the three magi from the east had done when they bowed low before Jesus and offered him gifts. Judas is worshiping here in verses 14 to 16. Problem is, he's just not worshiping Jesus. Judas is worshiping at the altar of money. And because of his deep love for money, in an extravagant act of worship, is willing to lay Jesus down. He's not breaking open a jar of ointment to pour over Jesus to worship him, but in order to worship money, he is breaking open Jesus in order to get the thing that he wants. So Judas, indignant at the woman who breaks the treasure and pours it on Jesus, he will break Jesus to pour treasure upon himself. And some who would witness this, hopefully that would be all of us in the room, would say, Judas, that is an extravagant cost for you to worship at the altar of money. That's too much. Because what you are giving up is Jesus. Jesus is the one who is meandering around the countryside, restoring broken bodies and healing them. We'd like him to keep doing that, Judas. Jesus is the one who is delivering people who have been in bondage from dark spiritual forces for long periods of time. He is setting them free, showing that he is a power among us who is greater than them. Judas, what are you doing? Let's keep him here. Jesus is the one who's raising the dead. I think we'd like to keep him present among us for as long as possible. Jesus, the one who is the light in the darkness. Judas says, I will sacrifice him in order for me to get 30 pieces of silver. And Judas says, no, laying Jesus down for 30 pieces of silver, no, it is not too extravagant. It is not too lavish. It is not too much. Why? Because he loves money. And if you love something, you will do things that are perceived to be unreasonable by others, but it makes absolute sense to you. Judas is operating in every part of his reasonability here. We will extravagantly worship that which we love. We will give much honor to what or who we love. The woman in Matthew 26 says, I love Jesus. And she extravagantly worshiped him. Judas says, I love money. And he extravagantly worshiped money. What say you? Back to Matthew chapter 2. Back to the Magi. Matthew chapter 2, verse 3. In response to the Magi coming from the east to worship the child who was born to be king of the one true God, come to send and to save the world, to rescue fallen humanity. Verse 3. When Herod the king heard of this from the Magi, he was troubled, and all of Jerusalem with him. And assembling all the chief priests and scribes of the people, he inquired of them where the Christ, the King, the Anointed One, was to be born. And they told him, in Bethlehem of Judea, for so it is written by the prophet. And at this point, Herod, just like the Magi from the east, Herod makes an extravagant offering. Herod engages in a lavish and extreme sacrifice, just like the Magi did. Except what Herod offers up is altogether different. Herod now will offer up all of the baby boys, 2 years old and under, that were born in the region of Bethlehem. He will offer them up freely by killing them. And he offers them up in an act of worship at the altar of power and ambition. It's where Herod worships, the altar of personal ambition and grasping for power. That's where Herod has spent his life worshiping, and here he is yet again. And then verse 16 unfortunately happens. Then Herod, when he saw that he had been tricked by the wise men, became furious, and he sent and killed all the male children in Bethlehem and in all that region who were 2 years old and under, according to the time that he had ascertained from the wise men. Seems a little bit extravagant doesn't it? Doesn't that seem like Herod, that is too much. That is too much of an offering that you have just made. And Herod's response would be, no, it is not. It is not too extravagant. It is not too lavish. It is not too much to offer up all of those young children in Bethlehem. Because Herod would say, no, it makes absolute sense, for I love power. I love ambition and chasing after more of it. And Herod would say, I will sacrifice more if need be to worship at this altar. And if you've ever read any history, you know that Herod was deeply consistent in his extravagance. And that when one of his very own sons, I think it actually happened twice, he had several family members murdered for fear that they would take away or usurp his power and thwart his ambition. There was no sacrifice that Herod would not offer in worship at the altar of ambition and power. The woman here in Matthew 26, she worships Jesus lavishly and extravagantly because she loves him. The Magi from the east come and they worship extravagantly, bowing low and offering gifts to Jesus. Why? Because they love him. Judas worships money, and he does so lavishly and extravagantly because he loves money. Herod worships power and ambition lavishly and extravagantly because he loves ambition and power. What say you? Every single one of us, because we have been made by God for certain things, we will spend our lives worshiping something. And when we worship anything that we love, we will do it lavishly and extravagantly. It is in our DNA to do so. This Christmas is an invitation to set our affections and our worship on the one true King, whom the Magi knew and saw to be the treasure above all treasures, whom the woman in Matthew 26 knew and saw to be the treasure above all treasures. And so they worshiped in ways that others would say, whoa, that's a little too much, don't you think? That's a bit unreasonable. And they say, no, it's not. And they, and our invitation is to follow them. The invitation is to break open whatever is needed so that we might worship him extravagantly. Because if we don't, we will find ourselves worshiping something that is far less than him. What a tragedy that is. And in worshiping something far less than him, we will spend our lives sacrificing the wrong things on the wrong altar. Worship team, come on back up. We're going to sing. End of the year is a time where many of us find ourselves being reflective over the year that has come before us. And if you think that these stories from the scriptures regarding Herod and Judas are abnormal, I could stay here for most of the afternoon telling you stories of people who I have witnessed worshiping at the wrong altars, giving up seemingly just about everything. I mean, it doesn't make sense to me, and I've had those conversations with them. but it makes sense to them. Just keep going. Losing spouses, losing children, because they're worshiping at the altar of something far less than Jesus. What a tragedy. Now, I'm guessing that we have assembled here this morning because we know what and who the true treasure is. I think that's why we come. And so now, for the next several moments, we're going to set our attention, maybe lavishly, maybe extravagantly. We're going to set our attention on the one true God, the same one true God that the wise men revered and loved and sought. We're going to set our attention on the same one, the child-born king who the woman poured that ointment over his head in lavish worship. We're going to set our affections on the same one. And maybe out there would be people walking by and they would look in and they'd say, "Whoa, dude, bro. Whoa, man, that's too much. It's a little excessive, don't you think? A little extravagant. What are you doing?" And our response would just be, "No, it is not too excessive. It is not enough. I wish I could do more. I wish my voice were louder. I wish my dancing body could do more. I wish I could get lower. I wish we could sing louder. I wish we could get more harmonious parts going in here to join with the chorus that's going up, because it's not too much." Why? Because of who He is and because we love Him. That's the Christmas invitation that we get. So let's join together and sing. Father in heaven, confess that we are oftentimes like those disciples who witness the lavish worship of the woman who anointed you. And sometimes we look at others who are worshiping, we say, "Whoa, too much. Whoa, that's weird. Wow, that's weird. I can't, that's too uncomfortable." But Father, the problem isn't with the person who worships you lavishly and extravagantly. It's not an unreasonableness problem that they carry, but it is more likely, and all unfortunately too often, a love problem in our own hearts. And so, Father, as we set our attention on you, I pray that you would do what happens when we set our attention on you, and that you would exceedingly rejoice our hearts with great joy. Just like the Magi who bowed low and the woman who gave the most valuable thing she had. Father, might you be lifted and honored among us. Would you set our attention and our worship on you and help us to that end, because you're worth it and because it's the only thing that brings us alive. We ask this in the name of Jesus, the King who has come. Amen.